From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, chaos in the GOP search for a Speaker of the House. Russia ramps up, U.S. pulls back in Syria, Hillary flips on the TPP, and epic flooding in South Carolina. Division and disarray in the House GOP. Congressman Kevin McCarthy, Republican frontrunner for Speaker of the House, bailed out.
If we are going to unite and be strong, we need a new face to help do that.
International trade agreement on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. Now the U.S. will debate at home. Hillary Clinton helped launch it. Now she says not in favor.
What I know about it as of today, I am not in favor of what I have learned about it.
And South Carolina struggles with the flood. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley yesterday.
You're seeing damage at levels we never thought we would see. The problem is more is coming.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with David Frum of The Atlantic, Laura Jakes from Foreign Policy, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's your take on the Republican House, the TPP, Russia in Syria? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And of course, we've been watching and thinking all this week about all that flooding in South Carolina. We want to hear from that front as well. Joining me from Washington, David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine. He was a speechwriter for George W. Bush, author of Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. David Frum, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you.
And from Washington, Laura Jakes joins us, deputy managing editor at Foreign Policy Magazine, former Baghdad bureau chief for the Associated Press. Laura Jakes, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. From Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, David, Lara.
Was everybody stunned yesterday on Capitol Hill when the Republican caucus got the news that Kevin McCarthy would not hang in as frontrunner for Speaker of the House? Yes, very much so. Here was Republican Peter King of New York, his first reaction.
People are absolutely stunned.
I mean, you were behind him. Are you stunned?
Yeah, totally stunned. No idea it was coming. No one did.
No idea. Conservatives had a lot to do within the GOP with making John Boehner look for the exits and Kevin McCarthy as well. Here's Tim Huelskamp, a congressman from Kansas, one of the 40 or so Republican members of the so-called House Freedom Caucus, endorsed Daniel Webster, said a speaker is needed that will work with conservatives.
We're looking for a speaker who works with conservatives rather than against us. And we presumed Kevin was going to reach out to us and say, hey, what do we need to do? What changes do we need to make?
The other side of that equation, here's moderate Republican Charlie Dent, Pennsylvania, speaking out against more right-wing members of his party and their unwillingness to compromise.
The next speaker should not appease those who make unreasonable demands. There are a number of members of our conference who simply cannot get the yes on anything.
Okay, David Frum, first to you. What is going on here? I mean, at one level, it's quite entertaining. At another, it's quite serious. We're talking about the Speaker of the House, second in line to the presidency. What's going on, David?
Well, this would be politics as usual if one candidate lost and there were another candidate ready to go who could defeat him.
Sure.
And if the conservatives had the votes, they're all conservative. The more conservative people had the votes to support a candidate of their own. What is striking and more than a little frightening is that there is no alternative, and the defeat of one candidate has led to the situation of a breakdown in the ability to govern. That's the real question mark over what is going on in Congress. Does one side have the votes to impose its vision on another? That's normal democracy. But in the lack of enough votes to impose your vision, are you able to stop the institution from functioning entirely?
You say no alternative. I mean, Daniel Webster is out there, favorite of the Freedom Caucus. Jason Chaffetz is out there, still pushing his candidacy hard. Not an alternative?
Well, neither of them will be elected. They don't have the votes. In the background to this debate are two substantive issues. One is the pending debate over the debt ceiling, where there is a lot of resistance to voting to raise it, and the other is the militant anger among some Republicans over the president's executive actions over immigration. The Republican Party is a party that is divided on the immigration issue. A lot of Republicans, including Kevin McCarthy, tacitly approve of what the president did. They don't like the way he did it, but they, on the substance, on the legalization of the 10 million plus illegal aliens in the country, they more or less are at peace with that. Then there is a substantial faction within the party that is very upset about it, that wants to have a more militant response, but they can't think of what it is. And so it is the debt ceiling and the immigration debate together that have inflamed opinion and made it impossible for Kevin McCarthy to step into this position.
Jack Beattie, Dana Milbeck writes today in the Washington Post, this isn't a leadership battle, it's a coup. What's he talking about?
Well, yeah, Peter King, you quoted him earlier. He put it similarly. He says the House has been transmogrified into a banana republic, rocked by coups, and that the coup makers are the members of the Tea Party. But you know, I'm going to go contrarian on this one, okay. Tom. I think the House GOP lucked out. Kevin McCarthy would have let down his colleagues whenever he appeared on TV. He's not only given the careless speech, viz. His guileless admission that the Benghazi committee was a hit job on Hillary Clinton, but cringe-inducing speech. Last week, the Washington Post documented his trouble delivering a written foreign policy address. He declared, quote, "We have isolated Israel while bolding places like Iran." He called for a safe zone to create a stem the flow of refugees. Russia's hybrid warfare came out as hybrid warfare, and so on. Dana Milbeck, you quote him, who was there, observed, "With the death of Yogi Berra, the new speaker may become the most famous misspeaker in America." Now that won't happen. Spared McCarthy, the Republicans have really embraced chaos.
Laura, I want to come to you on the implications abroad of all this, but David, what about, there's so much here, but there's this suggestion of an affair somewhere buried in all this. Threats against Kevin McCarthy to step aside or be subjected to this big Chicago-based GOP donor sending him an email. Kevin, why not resign like Bob Livingston, who, of course, did a decade and more ago, much more. Is there something in there, or is this just swirling rumor stuff? What's that, David?
Well, I have no idea, and if I did, I wouldn't talk about it on the radio.
Well, I mean, it's headlines but all over Washington right now.
But let's put it this way. If these kinds of accusations are trouble when you're in trouble already. But
right.
I think a substantial number of our elected officials lead less than faultless lives in a number of dimensions, and yet are still able to exercise political power. Some of them, you know, may have affairs. Some of them may smoke. Some of them may drink too much. Some of them may be in debt. Some of them may fail to exercise regularly. I mean, they have their faults. But these things become lethal only when there is some other crisis in your authority.
You know, David, we heard some people in the GOP saying today, look, if the Freedom Caucus is so bent on taking its own way here, they should leave the GOP, start their own party. We've got to have a party that can function, and it's not functioning right now. Is there a division too deep for effective functioning, effective governing within the GOP?
You know, this is the kind of thing that 3 months ago I would have laughed off. But I got an email about a month ago from the chief doorkeeper to one of the major, major donors in the Republican Party, a name, if I said it on the radio, you would recognize.
Okay.
And he wrote to me. He said, I think this party is going to split. And he thought, I mean, by the way, which he was in favor of. He wasn't horrified by that. And he thought that the forces that were gathering around Trump and Carson versus the forces that were gathering around Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio had become so antagonistic. We've got as well – it's not just an ideological divide. The Republican Party is a coalition of the wealthiest and the most affluent and most optimistic people in America and of some of the most hard-pressed and anxious people in America. And they have very different views on everything from trade to immigration to government spending to taxes. And one of the things that has happened in this presidential cycle and the overlap between the presidential cycle and what's going on in Congress is last time we saw these protest candidates, Herman Cain and Michelle Bachmann, and they were negligible figures. But this time the protest candidates are serious figures. I mean, Ben Carson, you may not like his views, but he's obviously a distinguished doctor. Donald Trump, very successful and famous person. The forces of insurgency have found leaders who are a lot more credible and have a lot more staying power than those leaders had in 2012.
Jack Beattie, you've got people saying, look, we had Daniel Webster on this week, favorite of the Freedom Caucus. And he said, this is not about ultra-conservative politics. This is just about process. We want a more open, bottom-up process, he insisted.
Yes, and you know, that sounds anodyne, and yet when you unpack it, what it apparently means, among other things, is that the House Freedom Caucus wants to be able to make illimitable amendments on the floor, essentially to circumvent the rulemaking authority of the Rules Committee, which could lead to all manner, well, for one thing, it could slow everything in the House, but it could also lead to tremendously embarrassing votes for other members. And also, according to reporting, they really want to be able to ignore the Senate, the Republican Senate. They don't want to have to answer to the Republican Senate's, to deal with the Republican Senate's bills, for example. And off the stage only this week, they're thinking about shutting down the government over Planned Parenthood. So, yes, it sounds, you know, we're just dealing with process, but behind this process talk is a pretty radical agenda.
Laura Jakes,
jump in here?
Yes, please.
It just occurs to me, listening to all of this, that if there's a real possibility of a party split within the Republican Party, that's only going to be something that's welcomed and beloved and helpful to the Democratic Party. I mean, if anybody had Kevin McCarthy's head on a stake this week, it was Hillary Clinton. She's been saying all along, as has the Democratic Party, that this Benghazi investigation that's initiated by House Republicans was politically motivated. Now you have Kevin McCarthy stepping down. The one substantive issue he said yesterday that caused him to reevaluate whether or not he wanted the speaker's job was that he made some inartfully worded statements on Benghazi. He was on Fox News a couple of weeks ago. He suggested that the reason why Hillary Clinton's polls numbers are going down is because of this investigation. And Democrats jumped on that. So, you know, I am not a political expert. I am not covering the presidential campaigns with as closely as some of my colleagues are. It just seems to me if the Republican Party is really talking about a split, that there are probably some rumblings in there as well, that that is something that's going to help the Democrats in 2016.
And yet, look at the whole country. How helpful can this be? Democrats may have jumped on it, but Republicans took his head, and they're going to have to, one way or another, figure out who will be Speaker of the House. Right now, Paul Ryan says he doesn't want it. Who will be? And what if it goes to a Freedom Caucus sympathetic leader? What does that mean for legislation? Laura Jakes at Foreign Policy, please stand by. David Frum with The Atlantic. Jack Beatty, this is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Republican chaos in the House. Russia cranks up in Syria. Hillary on the TPP and South Carolina struggling with epic flooding. Laura Jakes is with us from Foreign Policy. David Frum from The Atlantic. Jack Beatty's here. You can join us as well. What do you see in the GOP struggles over the House speakership? Should the U.S. tangle with Russia in Syria or let it do what it will? What do you think of the U.S. attack? Why do you think the U.S. attacked that hospital in Kunduz? And do you support the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP? Does Hillary look right or opportunistic in opposing it? Let's go to Prakash in Des Moines, Iowa. Prakash, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, Michael, a quick comment and question. I believe Representative Kevin McCarthy asking for all or none support is the right thing to do to avoid the status quo which we had during Speaker Boehner. So is that the right thing? And the second comment or question is, if Paul Ryan becomes the speaker, he will have the strong support of the 40, but he will struggle passing or getting anything to the floor, forget about going all the way to president's desk.
The support of the 40, the Freedom Caucus, Paul Ryan, do you think he'll ultimately step up and try and do this, David Frum?
I'm guessing he probably will. There'll be a lot of pressure on him, and it is he's an ambitious person. I don't think it will make the problems go away for two reasons. One is the debt ceiling issue will not vanish. There are Republicans who think that it is a lever what they can use to extract concessions from the president they haven't gotten until now. And the other is immigration, this great fault line of the party. Paul Ryan is not as strongly with the support the Path to Citizenship group as Kevin McCarthy was, but that is the camp of the party he's in. And those who want to organize some kind of resistance to the president's executive actions that have effectively legalized millions of illegals won't be satisfied with Paul Ryan, even if they love him on other issues.
Tom in Webb City, Missouri. Tom, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I'm just curious if someone can explain to me how 40-some Congress people can gridlock an entire Congress. They're elected, obviously, to represent their constituents. However, the other 200-plus congressmen are elected to represent their constituents. And if they're moderate and there are things that need to be done to get this government moving forward, I wonder why the majority of the Republicans in Congress are allowing 40-some people to tell them what's going to happen, where we're going to move in this country.
That's a great question, Tom. Jack Beatty, speak to that. I heard one commentator saying, look, Republicans redistricted for congressional districts where no compromise was necessary. In fact, compromise was dangerous. That created a hard wall against Democrats, but now it's created a hard nut within their own party that they can't crack.
Yes, indeed. And they have also limited themselves with this so-called Hastert rule, meaning we will not put legislation on the floor unless it commands a majority of Republican members. Well, that's an impossible demand for a lot of legislation. In fact, many of the major things that have been done in this House have been done by disregarding that rule. Nevertheless, that's there, and that's one of the demands of the Freedom Caucus. They want that restored. They want that to be the rule of the place. And of course, in a government where the other party occupies the presidency, that's a recipe for gridlock, because the kind of legislation they would pass under the Hastert rule, all of that would be dead on arrival in the Senate, and if it got through the Senate, vetoed by the president.
David Frum, get your crystal ball out here. If Paul Ryan won't or can't effectively step up to be Speaker of the House, where might this turn? With what consequence?
I suspect that some compromise candidate will be found who will be an even weaker figure than John Boehner has been able to be. The last question, which is a very powerful one, mm-hmm. has to understand that the Republican Party is not between 40 people who think one way and 200 or so who think a different way. That there's a compact group of 40 who agree on just about everything, and they are then surrounded by a wider satellite belt of people who mostly agree with them, certainly don't want to get on the wrong side of them. The other 200 don't form a coherent group. And the last thing, and this is one of the ways that American politics has changed For 40 years, modern-minded reformers have been systematically stripping the leadership of the House of Representatives of the instrumentalities of power. And I think we're all a little implicated in this because, you know, if we were on NPR 40 years ago, everything that the Speaker of the House did to rule the House would seem bad. The use of committee assignments, the centralized control of party funds, the control over nomination through the use of state parties. All of those instruments have been taken away. Members raise their own money. The leadership doesn't really control access to the committees anymore. It is not things do not proceed by seniority. The ability to discipline and punish wayward members is much weaker than it was. And the result is not that we have this wonderful participatory democracy. The result is you have chaos.
Peter King says banana republic.
Right. But one of the things that I think we all have to make up our mind about is we have to rethink, in my opinion, the past half century of political reform. If you're going to make representative institutions work, you need strong power at the center. And to have strong power at the center, you need the instrumentalities of power, including a lot of secrecy and a lot of ability to exercise patronage.
Is that what Kevin McCarthy was talking about when he said something like maybe the GOP has to hit rock bottom before we can get out of this? I mean, does that mean we're going to sink further in terms of effectuality there?
Well, the United States has a lot of institutions that don't work very well, and it's not just the GOP caucus and the House of Representatives. The executive branch doesn't work as well as it used to do either, because to make large organizations work, you have to have certain kinds of tools that modern America is very uncomfortable with.
Boy, we're going to watch that. Everybody will be watching that. Everything in Congress that's riding on the next few weeks and months and how this split gets resolved. I want to turn to the Syrian front. Russia released a video of their ships in the Caspian Sea this week, releasing rockets intended for Syria. Rockets and a whole lot more. All kinds of fighters down there bombing, a battalion on the ground. They've got the port on the Mediterranean and this new base inside Syria. On Wednesday, Defense Secretary Ash Carter said the U.S. was not collaborating with the Russians as they continue to strike targets other than ISIS.
I've said before that we believe Russia has the wrong strategy. They continue to hit targets that are not ISIL. We believe this is a fundamental mistake.
Sounded a little bit like a professor there, just looking at whether their strategy was right or wrong. Got a little tougher in Brussels yesterday on the Russians. Ash Carter.
We've seen increasingly unprofessional behavior from Russian forces. They have initiated a joint ground offensive with the Syrian regime, shattering the facade that they're there to fight ISIL. This will have consequences for Russia itself, which is rightfully fearful of attack upon Russia. And I also expect that in coming days, the Russians will begin to suffer casualties in Syria.
And now, today, the news that the U.S. will pull the plug on training rebels in Syria after the investment of $500 million in that effort, failed effort by all assessments. Laura Jakes, is the U.S. Effectively turning this over to Russia, saying it's all yours? Quagmire, take it.
Well, you know, President Obama came into office saying that he was not going to get involved in another ground war in Asia. It seems that he is going to stick to that line of attack. I mean, with situations like these, they really are an all-or-nothing battle. You really can't do it halfway. And that's what the U.S. seems to be acknowledging now, that this $500 million program, which is only about $50 million of which has been spent, it was aiming to train and equip as many as about 5,000 rebels this year alone to fight against ISIL.
Last I heard, they had, what, 40, 50? And then zero, five, okay.
Four or five. It seems that they've only trained about 70 rebels, but the vast majority of those defected. And in the meantime, a lot of their equipment has ended up in the hands of al-Nusra, which is the al-Qaeda-backed group in Syria. So by any stretch, this was a totally unsuccessful program. The Obama administration realizes that, and they are not going to do it anymore. Now, the question becomes, what will they do, if anything? President Obama has made clear that he is not going to negotiate with Russia. He is not going to try to work with Russia. They see Russia as a bad actor with a bad agenda here. Russia wants to pump up its ally, Bashar al-Assad. The United States has been saying for 3-4 years now that Assad must go. They cannot close this delta. So President Obama is expected to speak today, and the White House is expected to speak today, at least, on this. We're going to have to see how he describes where this is going to go. Show me how this ends after almost 5 years of civil war, 200,000 people dead.
He'll be on 60 Minutes on Sunday. We have a little excerpt of him there talking with Steve Croft, and you hear him kind of saying, hey, this is not going to be fun for Putin. Here's Obama, the president.
Mr. Putin now is devoting his own troops, his own military, just to barely hold together by a thread his sole ally.
And he's challenging your leadership, Mr. President. Challenging your leadership.
Steve, I got to tell you, if you think that running your economy into the ground and having to send troops in order to prop up your only ally is leadership, then we've got a different definition of leadership.
Jack Beatty, what do you see going on here? Is the U.S. walking further away? Or, I mean, you got Zbigniew Brzezinski saying this week that we are at risk of stumbling into world war, raising the specter of World War I, where you had militaries running around. Pretty soon there's conflict and everybody's in on it. Incendiary, Jack, or washing hands and it's all Russia's?
Well, Brzezinski was really making the point that the Russians are bombing our admittedly dodgy allies, the Sunni Arab fighters who serve with jihadis in the anti-Assad coalition. These are people who we've made some promises to and who are presumably our allies of a kind. And so, you know, he's saying, Brzezinski says, put Putin on notice. Meanwhile, you quoted Ash Carter, typical of the administration line. He calls the Russian strategy incorrect. Russia's strategy is not incorrect. It's contemptuous of American power. Putin seems to believe that President Obama is weak and the president's people are sounding anything but strong. You know, to stop the drift to war by miscalculation, the 1914 scenario, Obama really needs to deter Putin and fast. Don't call it a red line, Mr. President, but tell Putin thus far and no farther.
David Frum, you were in the thick of this back in the George W. Axis of Evil days. What do you see unfolding here now? U.S. Getting into a potentially a confrontation with Russia or sliding out?
Yeah, I'm going to want to register one pedantic historical point, which
Please.
Is a protest against the claim that that the world drifted to war in 1914. The Germans and the Austrians really wanted that war. They just didn't want the outcome. But I think in a larger sense, to bring us up to the present, that what I am a little allergic to this. I'm not usually someone who is sympathetic to President Obama, but to this attempt to make this foreign policy crisis a psychodrama about the president's position in the world. That's not what this is about. The United States, there's no one in Syria we are for. And that limits our ability to say what we are against, because you can't veto everybody. Somebody has to exercise power. And if we don't like any of the candidates, but we also don't want chaos, then we have no position at all. So I don't know what basis we have for a serious conflict with Russia. We don't like what they're doing. They shouldn't be doing it. But
so are you the George McGovern here? Come home, America.
No, not in general. But
here,
not in Syria, I think we need to be very, very modest. What are we trying? What are our goals in Syria? Well, obviously to limit the humanitarian toll of this horrific war and to end the refugee flow to Europe. The refugee flow to Europe is going to destabilize our European allies. Is going to destabilize the very concept of the European Union. We want to mitigate fighting to the extent that we can, and we want to contain this violence within the borders of Syria as much as possible. But we don't have a candidate to run Syria, and that means we cannot get into a conflict with other people who do have candidates, because something and someone is going to rule there, and we don't have a choice.
We said we don't want Assad. I'll bring it to you, Laura. Nora in Hanover, New Hampshire. Nora, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a Syrian American and whose family recently left Syria and are now refugees in Turkey. So I have a comment and a question.
Okay.
I've lost distant family members to all fighting factions in Syria, and I'm registered as an independent and find Jeb Bush is the only major candidate talking about a no-fly zone, removing Assad, stopping the barrel bombs, and this would require an international collaboration that would alleviate the Syrian refugee crisis, and Syrians can also return home and rebuild their country.
But Nora, doesn't that look like ancient history? Now you've got Russia in there flying all over the place in support of Assad with much more than barrel bombs. They've got serious big fighter bombers in there.
Exactly. That's why this takes an international collaboration. NATO must put pressure on Russia. The U.S. must put pressure on Russia. And Obama needs to follow with his unfulfilled promises. We need to save humans that are living there. How many more Syrians have to die until the world takes action? We're standing by watching videos every day of kids drowning or kids just bleeding to death.
Nora, we've got it. And I apologize, but our time is short before the break. And I'm sorry for your family's travail there. Laura Jakes, it looks to me as though the world is engaged in a big way right now. Russia is the tip of the spear, but it's not for those who pushed against Assad. It's for Assad. And Russia's saying, you want an end to the refugees? Let Assad win.
Well, I mean, going back to something that was talked about earlier, and Nora, salam alaikum, I'm sorry to hear about, obviously, your family's experience in Syria. With President Obama saying basically to Russia, bring it,
I think he's
Iranian
not saying
general.
Bring it. He's saying have it. It's all yours. Not let's.
That's right. Fair enough. Mm-hmm. Yes. He's saying you take it. You want that fight. Bring it. Bring that fight to Syria. Have at it. Today we saw an Iranian general killed in Syria. Yesterday we saw some Russian missiles go down in Iran.
Is today that confirmed now? We saw those reports.
I think it's pretty well confirmed.
Wow.
I think that Ash Carter was talking
about
it.
Those missiles out of the Caspian Sea, boom, down in Iran. Wrong target.
Correct.
Wrong place.
Correct.
Yep.
Meanwhile, the Islamic State is moving on Aleppo this morning. So you've got three kind of data points that the Obama administration can point to and say, listen, this is a harder nut to crack. You want to go in there and fix things, you're going to get tangled up in this quagmire as well. So have at it. Good luck with that. I was kind of writing down a little list of things that I was thinking about when David was talking. Yes, a World War III would be obviously a terrible thing, the worst consequence to come out of this. Right now we see NATO being very prepared to stand by Turkey and say we are not going to let Turkey be caught in the middle of this. But the fighters who have been the most successful in this fight have been the Kurds that oppose Turkey, and Turkey is going after the Kurds. couple of other things are happening in Syria. Do we want to risk Syria becoming a safe haven for the Islamic State and extremists? That could happen very easily. And do we want Syria to become the end of a Shia crescent that can lift over from Iran through Iraq and into Syria and Lebanon? That's something that the Saudis and the Gulf partners of the United States would greatly, greatly oppose.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, the Nobel Committee announced its winner of the 2015 Nobel Peace Prize, Tunisia's National Dialogue Quartet, for helping the country's transition to democracy.
The quartet paved the way for a peaceful dialogue between the citizens, the political parties, and the authorities, and helped to find consensus-based solutions.
The announcement there today out of Oslo. Fantasy sports companies under attack for insider trading or action. Here's New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman.
It's a rigged casino, and we have no way of knowing that right now because this has been totally unregulated.
And Hillary Clinton played a bartender, Val, on Saturday Night Live, consoling a fictional Hillary Clinton, played by Kate McKinnon, about a certain GOP candidate.
All anyone wants to talk about is Donald Trump.
Donald Trump? Isn't he the one that's like,
you're all losers?
We're looking at a week in the news with Laura Jakes from Foreign Policy, David Frum from The Atlantic. Jack Beatty is here. You can join us. Do you support the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership? Does Hillary Clinton look right or opportunistic in opposing it this week? What do you make of Ben Carson saying the students should have rushed the shooter in Roseburg, Oregon? South Carolina, are you hanging in there? What are we learning from this flood? It was a long, long, long negotiation. Started when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, maybe even before elements of it. On Tuesday, negotiators finally came to a finalized agreement, and President Obama celebrated the deal.
Ultimately, we're going to get this done, and it will be a enormous achievement for us to be able to make sure that 40% of the world's economy is operating under rules that don't hurt us, but instead help make sure that American workers and American businesses are getting a fair shot.
The next day, Hillary Clinton, who had once called it the gold standard in trade agreements, said no, it hasn't worked out to her satisfaction. No to TPP.
I have said from the very beginning that we had to have a trade agreement that would create good American jobs, raise wages, and advance our national security. And I still believe that's the high bar we have to meet. But I'm worried. I'm worried about currency manipulation not being part of the agreement.
Jack Beatty, it was very, very carefully couched. She, in her statement, she said, based on what I know so far, I can't support this agreement. The bar's set high. Based on what I have seen, I don't believe this agreement has met it. Now, we know she was under big pressure from unions who have been leaning toward Bernie Sanders. She's been a very outspoken critic of this. What do you see in Hillary Clinton's coming out against the TPP this week, Jack?
Well, Tom, you know, she has good ideas and bad political judgment. This week, the policy wonk outlined a comprehensive gun control program. The pandering Paul came out against the TPP. You know, suppose she had endorsed it. The media would have hailed it. It would have been her sister soldier moment, shorthand for base-defying courage. Yeah, but in next week's Democratic debate, her opponents would have pummeled her. Oh, you're endorsing a new NAFTA. But she could have defended TPP on national security grounds and won points for loyalty to Obama. Now the opponents on the stage are going to attack her for spurning a deal that, as Secretary of State, she praised over 40 times. And the media is already citing that inconsistency as yet more evidence of a flawed character. A new poll of three swing states just came out the other day reveals that voters rank Donald Trump, a TV pitchman who makes everything up as he goes along as more trustworthy than Hillary Clinton.
But, Jack, all of us had to wait to see what the final details will be. She says she's not satisfied with the way it turned out in the end. Yes, you know, she said it sets the gold standard, but here we are years later, and she doesn't like the currency manipulation aspect of this. She says it doesn't give Americans enough benefits on the pharmaceutical side. What about the possibility of a legitimate survey of the contents and, you know, bottom line, no?
I really don't believe that that's the case. And experts on this who look at it in with the pharmaceutical question in mind and with the currency manipulation question in mind say that her critique doesn't really match the with known facts about the treaty. That, for example, our drug companies were forced to yield more than they wanted to, which is creating trouble with the Republican Senate. And on the currency manipulation, there's a complication there that doesn't really her objection doesn't speak to it.
Laura Jakes, the Obama administration has made the case that A, this will be good for the American economy, that it integrates this Pacific region under an American kind of regime of rules, and it is necessary as a counterweight to rising Chinese power and influence. Can Hillary Clinton just turn away from those arguments?
Well, yeah, I think that it'll be interesting to see how Congress debates this and whether she changes her tune one way or another after the 90-day wait to see what Congress does. Congress has to approve this or reject it. This isn't a done deal just yet. It kind of made me laugh listening to your intro on Saturday Night Live. It occurred to me that this is one of the issues that actually unites Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Donald Trump also opposes the TPP. He says it'll benefit foreign countries. So there's a huge domestic backdrop to this argument. But, you know, this is also, as you know, this is something that's supposed to kind of counterweight China's growing might in global economics. China has
in
the
Asia,
world's
especially,
second,
of course, yeah.
Yeah, well, exactly. But, I mean, it's going to raise Japan and Korea and some of the other groups or, I'm sorry, nations in the Pacific Rim. And it will help them compete against China. But, you know, China's economy is very, very wobbly right now. And so not only will it serve as a counterbalance to keep China from growing too fast and overpowering some of its competitors, it might give more stability to the global economy.
David Frum, how do you see this playing out politically? Yes, the president has to say that go, and then there's 90 days for the Congress to get to it. It could go all the way into next spring, depending on when the signal is given. Do you see a majority coming together and this thing ending up a signed agreement by the U.S. all the way through Congress?
Not only do I not doubt it will become an signed agreement, I fully expect that if Hillary Clinton is the president of the United States, she will sign it. And I can't imagine that there's anybody who seriously doubts that a president Hillary Clinton will sign it. That's what makes the phoniness of her position so painful. It's so manifestly, glaringly phony. It's not even halfway credible. And what it reveals is that although she is thought of as the certain favorite for the Democratic Party, how weak she is within her party. I remember very vividly George W. Bush's drive for the Republican nomination in 1999-2000. He had a credible opponent in Senator John McCain, but he was the decisive favorite. And he took advantage of the fact that he was the favorite to be able to move his party in all kinds of ways that many people will miss now. And he challenged Republicans to accept Medicare as a normal part of the American landscape. He insisted he would not do his budget balancing on the backs of the poor. And he made his party didn't always like it, but he made them accept it, and he made himself a stronger general election candidate and potentially a better president, certainly somebody who pointed a better way for the Republicans to govern than we've seen in recent times. Hillary Clinton, who has a much bigger lead over her opponents than George W. Bush did, is acting like a much weaker and more fragile candidate than he ever did.
Martin O'Malley coming out this week calling her new position a case study in political expediency. Gwen in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Gwen, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a million things to say. I'll keep it to two.
Okay.
The people's view here. Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State. She was serving at the pleasure of the president. She had to, advocate for his agenda. It was his agenda. Now she is an independent human, person out in the world, and she is looking at the TPP, which, as far as I know, is not even completely 100% public and available for us to scrutinize. She said, as far as she's seen, she doesn't approve of it. Also, she's right to not approve of it if it were purely on environmental grounds, which I understand she didn't mention in that interview. It is going to be devastating in terms of climate change. As I understand it, though it is secret, it has been completely secretive, the process, other countries can bring a case against our environmental laws. I don't know about the labor laws, but against our environmental laws, and there's something like a council of three supposedly mutually agreed upon mediators who would decide whether, you know, the country's claim that our environmental laws are impinging on their profits, and our environmental laws can be overruled.
Jack, Gwen, I appreciate your call. Jack, there's a lot of serious opposition to this, people who just don't want it. They look back at the trade agreements over the last couple of decades and say, net, net, are we better off? Are working Americans better off? We don't want it. So, you know, Gwen says, hey, she worked for the president when she was supportive. Now she's her own woman, and she should judge it on its own terms.
Fair-minded estimate. Hillary Clinton spoke to that in her interview with Judy Woodruff. She said, look, when I became Secretary of State, we had a trade deal, sort of an embryo from the Bush administration with South Korea. We went ahead with it. And she cited data saying this hasn't worked to our advantage. A loss of, 75,000 American jobs credited to the trade deficit with South Korea. And, of course, it was supposed to be just the other way around. So she can point to that as evidence that she, you know, is sadder but wiser about trade deals. But I entirely agree with David that as president, she would do exactly what President Obama did with NAFTA. Remember, he was elected with, oh, I'm going to reopen NAFTA. And now the White House is saying, oh, he did. He talked to the Canadians. Maybe around the edges. But he left NAFTA alone. Any president would go for this deal for the national security reasons, for the future embracing reasons, and all the rest of it, and whether rightly or wrongly for average Americans. But I do think that the O'Malley charge is I'm more persuaded by that what really dictated this was to get through next week's debate. For Hillary.
Tuesday in Las Vegas, the first big debate by the Democrats. South Carolinians, we want to hear from you on how you're getting through, or not, the flood. Let's go to another candidate who took some grief this week, Ben Carson. He was on Fox and Friends on Tuesday talking about the shootings in Roseburg, Oregon, and saying, hey, you know, those people there in the room with the gunman, they should have rushed the gunman and taken him down. Here was Ben Carson Tuesday.
I would not just stand there and let him shoot me. I would say, hey, guys, everybody attack him. He may shoot me, but he can't get us all.
There was his advice, and it was seen as kind of hectoring of people who had suffered a tragedy. David Frum, what about Ben Carson? He raised a lot of money in the last quarter, a lot more than Ted Cruz, a lot more than Marco Rubio, who's getting a lot of attention. But this week he took a couple of hits.
Well, there was a U.S. Army officer who was at the shooting scene, who did rush the gunman, and who suffered nine wounds. Mercifully, he's alive, but he seems to have been quite badly hurt, and we all wish him a recovery.
But was Ben Carson wrong to say that? I mean, I had the same thought, I must say. You know, if you lay on the floor as instructed and get picked off one by one, that doesn't sound too good. If everybody got up, he couldn't get everyone. I mean, maybe it's wrong for a presidential candidate to say it, but is there something wrong with Ben Carson saying it?
Yes, there's something wrong with it. Here's what's wrong with it. If we had a mass shooting once every 2 or 3 years, as happens in other countries, because you know we can never live in a perfect world, then that would certainly be wise advice in that rare freakish incident. That's how and people will have to risk their lives, and some that may work, it may not. When you're having a couple of these a week, the suggestion that the thing that is missing is insufficient personal heroism on the part of shooting victims. People shouldn't have to be so heroic in order to live lives of safety and security. And the reason we have states in the first place, we have governments in the first place, is precisely to allow most of us to go around our business not being superhuman. It's true. We could all bring our food taster with us to the restaurant and have somebody make sure that the food is not poisoned.
Are you suggesting more guns on the hips of people in that room, or more gun control?
I'm suggesting fewer guns everywhere. I'm saying that a civilized society is one in which guns are in the hands of law enforcement authorities and sportsmen.
That has not really flown in the Republican side of the aisle, and not even that high on the Democratic side. I want to turn to the South Carolina flood. It has just been heartbreaking to watch day after day after day. First, the hurricane and the rains, and then the dams bursting and more problems with drinking water and all the rest. Here was Governor Nikki Haley on NBC's Today Show on Monday saying, look, this is as big as it gets.
This is historic levels of rain. We've never seen anything like this before, and we're used to rain on the coast. To see it all the way up in the upstate and the mountains, that's not something we're used to. I think the highest level we've seen so far is 24 inches.
Next day, Tuesday, Lindsey Graham, South Carolina senator, requested federal aid for his home state after the flood's devastation was so widespread. Of course, in 2013, he had voted against similar help for New Jersey in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy.
As we get through this and look at the damages, that comes later. And we will ask only that is what is responsible. We're not going to ask the federal government to do anything that's beyond the responsibility of the government.
Asking only what's responsible sounds like trying to distance himself from the earlier Sandy situation. Montague in Fort Mill, South Carolina. Thanks for calling, Montague. You're on.
Hey, Tom. I don't think this ever really should have happened. I mean, there are three main rivers that flow into the Columbia area, and each one of those have about two or three dams, and each one of those dams hold a bunch of water. And I think it was a lack of coordinated effort to release the water from these dams.
But you did have epic amounts of rainfall, did you not?
Oh, yeah, and it was all over the Carolinas, and all that water flows into the rivers, and if those dams don't hold the water, I mean, just in my area alone, we're at the average level. We're not even at flood level. We could have held so much more water in our lake.
Needed more dams. People talk about more big weather events like this coming with climate change. Do you worry about the future of the infrastructure and how it's handled in your state?
Yeah, we definitely have to coordinate. I mean, or this is going to just continue happening.
I mean, the cost already of rebuilding private homes and public infrastructure, hundreds of roads and bridges and all the rest in big trouble there. David Frum, coastal crisis has become kind of a normative thing.
I want to say a word in defense of Lindsey Graham. It's pretty notorious that state governments use these crises afterwards to put a lot of projects they've wanted to do onto the federal budget. Lindsey Graham is signaling, this is not an invitation for the feds to rebuild every bike path we've ever imagined having in South Carolina.
It may be more than bike paths that need rebuilding, though, if this becomes the way of the waves and rain in our country. Well, we'll see. Lindsey Graham putting a little distance between themselves and other devastating storms, though it's been devastating for South Carolina this week. David Frum with The Atlantic, it's been great to have you with us this hour. Thank you so much for joining us. Laura Jakes at Foreign Policy, thank you so much, Laura.
My pleasure.
And Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. Have a good weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.